Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Debra and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, I'm Dr. Debra.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly.
No, you gotta say that in French.
Bonjour, je m'appelle Kelly.
Bonjour.
You know, it's so funny. I was, for those of you who don't
just
know,
got back last night from Paris.
And I got there and I would speak in French and they'd answer me in English.
No way.
And it drove me bananas.
Because you wanted to really dive in.
By the end of the trip, they responded to me in French.
Oh.
I was like, yes.
Were these people at the hotel or?
Just on the street or if I was asking directions or whatnot. But apparently the American accent's pretty strong. They know immediately. Like
that. Oh, yeah, so you got better as you conversed more in.
I see.
You sent that lovely picture of you in front of the place that you lived when you were 21.
It was amazing. That was lovely. And what's so cool about Paris is not much changes on the outside.
Really?
Like they just renovate the apartments on the inside, but everything else kind of stays structurally.
Oh.
So it was cool. So I felt like I was really back there.
Oh,
it was
what
amazing.
Did you end up doing?
I did a ton of shopping. I did a ton of shopping. It was amazing. Because I'd been there, I didn't want to like do all the touristy stuff. I've done all the museums. So really for me, it was just walking around and talking to people and shopping. And I did all of that. I mean, we did some of the touristy stuff too.
What is it, the Champs-Élysées?
Yeah, the Champs-Élysées. So that was awesome. And we went to, and then I actually took a train 45 minutes outside the city. They have like French outlets. So that
was so
cool. Yes, I went berserk.
Did David shop too?
No, he stayed back. He's like, he hates shopping. Like,
so you didn't join you?
Every day except for that outlet day, which was great because then I didn't feel like pressure. You know, like he'd be sitting in the man chair, bored to tears. So it was perfect. I got to do my thing.
Did you have a budget?
No budget.
Nope. Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, exactly. No budget. This was my birthday, like, you know, belated. So my parents gave me a little bit of money. It was like, goodbye and au revoir. And I'll see you on the other side. It was great.
Oh.
It was awesome.
That's beautiful. Yay. And your boys did okay.
My boys did amazing.
Her boys were not on the trip.
No, they were not. They stayed with my parents.
But
they
had to fly them to your parents.
Yes. And they experienced D.C. And then my parents took them to New York. They saw Aladdin. The show.
Oh.
Yeah, they had a great time.
Now, what is London marking with food? Because he loves to talk about.
Yes, they went to the M&M store.
Okay.
And then they went to see the Statue of Liberty, right? And I'm like, oh, what was that like? He goes, they gave pretzels on the ferry. Yes. He doesn't care about anything else, just the pretzels on the ferry. That is my child. It's hilarious. Yeah, I know. It's really funny, right? Like that. It's so scary how like he literally like that. That's how he classifies different things about what he ate. And he remembers it.
Well, our guest today may have a little
bit
to
exactly.
say about that.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my goodness, I'm so glad that you got to have that trip, and that's so wonderful.
And
I'm so glad that they did well. So now you won't feel as guilty.
Yes.
If you leave them behind, as long as there's M&Ms and pretzels,
exactly, they're good to go.
Oh my
gosh. How was the week? Mm. I'm so sad that I missed it.
No, you cannot be sad for even one moment.
All right.
We did great. It was a great show last week. Oh, happy Passover and happy Easter.
Yes.
I know we're past Easter, but Passover is still going on.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the family Seder at
my
stepsister's.
Did?
Yeah, I didn't do it.
Oh my God.
Went. Yes.
I'm amazed.
Matzo balls.
Wait, are you keeping Passover? Kind of?
No.
Okay.
Well, I gave up my rye bread in the morning.
That's pretty good.
I bought a box of matzah.
Oh, my. That's actually pretty good. I'm not doing anything. So that's why I'm impressed with
and
you.
And you're a much better Jew than I am.
You know what? I don't even think I'm a great Jew, so I don't know what that says. I'm not so good. I have a Christmas tree in the winter, so I don't know.
But I do like making matzo ball soup, though.
And so do I. I love matzo ball soup.
Do you make it?
Yeah, actually, I do, but from a box.
Yeah, that's
does that
okay.
count?
Yeah.
All right, then.
Yeah, you still have to put the stuff
exactly,
in there.
Exactly, yeah.
Let them fluff up and
yes.
float.
You know what? That's a good idea. Maybe I'll make it for tonight. That's a great idea.
Great idea.
But so anyway, okay, so you did that. That's great.
Yeah, it was nice. And then just kind of hung out over the weekend. I can't even remember. It feels like every day just sort of blurs.
Yeah.
Started a new little job at one of the treatment centers.
Oh, that's
doing
right.
Some consulting in a group. My first DBT group, dialectical behavioral therapy. I bought the workbook and I was trying to figure it out because I wasn't formally trained in it.
Right.
But I mean, when I was reading this stuff, it's like, I know all this stuff. I just do this intuitively anyway.
Uh-huh.
Anyway.
Exactly.
So, what you did miss last week was Nancy Siegel, Dr. Nancy Siegel, the author of Twin Mythconceptions, in which she described false beliefs and fables surrounding twins and provided much-needed correction. And she also talked about her sixth book, which is coming out, Accidental Brothers, which is really interesting, following the life histories of two identical Colombian twins who were separated at birth, okay. And then they found each other later on.
That's so cool.
So crazy, by some small person that was at a butcher. And
no.
Yeah. So if you forgot and didn't listen to that show, mm-hmm. please go take a listen to Dr. Nancy Siegel. And we had my friend Misty Barnes, who was the co-host.
That's great.
Yeah.
I'll check it out, too.
She's been on a few times. Okay. Drum roll. Yay. So we've had a little bit of a food and eating theme the last month. So this is going to cover some of the more intense eating disorder stuff. But today mm-hmm. we have Carolyn Costin, the author of 8 Keys to Recovery from an Eating Disorder, and also a workbook that goes along with that, which is fantastic. She is a world-renowned, highly sought-after eating disorder clinician, author, and international speaker. She recovered from anorexia in her 20s, and as a young therapist, Carolyn recognized her calling after successfully treating her first eating disorder client. Carolyn was first to publicly take the position that people with eating disorders can become fully recovered. Carolyn's contributions to the field are extensive. 6 books, service in every major eating disorder organization, 3 decades of training professionals worldwide, free study groups, and the outstanding success of Montanito all spurred Carolyn to international acclaim. Welcome, Carolyn.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here on the show.
We are so excited. So give us some more about your history, what drew you to this field. Obviously, you disclosed in your bio that you had an eating disorder. Kelly and I can relate to that because mm-hmm. she and I both had some variation of that. And then your career path, because I know you've done so much.
That's amazing.
Wow. Well, that just might take too much time. I guess what might be interesting for people is just the idea that I recovered from anorexia nervosa many, many years ago, over 40 some years ago, and I never thought at that time that I would be an eating disorder therapist. I went to school and became a teacher, and then I became a therapist, but I was going to treat adolescents. But a few cases started, you know, someone had anorexia in the town I was living in and was referred, oh, you should see this girl because she has that thing you had, you know,
wow.
kind of like that.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, I think because I had anorexia, because I recovered from it, I think that is what, and the timing of things, is what set me up to end up making a whole career and become a well-known eating disorder therapist. Because I just recovered, and so I felt like if I recovered, so can everyone else, and
sure.
I never really looked back. And when people started treating this illness and writing about it, they were talking about how difficult it is to treat, and, you know, I understand that, but I do think that I had a sense about it and a belief that every person I saw was going to get better, and I think in some ways that contributed to my success as a therapist in eating disorders. And then it just went on from there. You know, I ended up thinking, you know, I have a lot of hard cases. You know, over the years, everybody was referring eating disorder cases to me, and
mm-hmm.
I realized at some point I need a place to put these people when they're so sick that, you know, they come to me at, you know, 56 pounds, for example, you know. And really, that's how Montanito, my clinics, got started. My residential treatment centers got started, and then I became very known for that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that. I don't know what else you want to know about that. Well, it's probably more interesting to talk about how it is people heal.
Absolutely. But just one more thing. So you do have another different center now, or what? Where does that stand?
Now I'm training. I have an institute, the Carolyn Costin Institute. where I am training therapists. I give CEUs to therapists and train them in terms of treating eating disorders. And that's online, but also I do lectures, you know, at workshops and things. But I'm also training people to be eating disorder coaches. And that's a new area for eating disorders. It's been around for a long time in chemical dependency, mm-hmm. you know, sober coaches and life coaches and even different kinds of business coaches and all that. But eating disorders coaching has been tried a little bit here and there, but it hasn't been seen that well. It hasn't been thought of as highly, I think, by professionals in the field, worried about people who were doing the coaching, a lot of things. And I think the eating disorder coaching needed somebody who had a background and some expertise to train people. So after Montanito, I sold Montanito a couple of years ago, and after that, I sort of fell into this thinking, you know, that's a missing piece in the treatment of eating disorders, especially people who are recovered who want to give back and help, but they don't have any training. So I started training, and I have a certification program now where I train people who want to be eating disorder coaches, and it's a very rigorous, sophisticated training with supervision and all of that. And so that's a lot of where my attention is these days.
That's awesome.
It's amazing. Yeah. So I want to know, I'm going to play devil's advocate. Why do you feel that most people who are eating disorder therapists feel like, oh, you cannot fully recover, or you can never be cured, or, yeah, I would love your thoughts around that.
I think partly it's because when eating disorders became sort of well-known or prominent, whatever you want to call it, they really were sort of trickling in terms of our understanding and knowledge about eating disorders in the 70s, let's say. Mm-hmm. And what happened as when Karen Carpenter died and was on the cover of, I think, Time magazine in the early 80s,
yeah.
One of the things happened is places started springing up, people started recognizing eating disorders more, and, you know, it looks a lot like an addiction. There's a lot of addictive components to an eating disorder, but I think addiction doesn't necessarily have to equal 12-step treatment. And what happened was people started, especially, you know, hospital programs started saying, we'll just treat it right along with the way we treat other addictions, because mm-hmm. after all, especially binge eating looks a lot like addiction. Bulimia, mm-hmm. Anorexia, it's a little bit different, but you can see how the person gets addictive components to it. But it started to be treated like that in these certain populations, and they adopted the AA book.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
There became, you know, there was an OA book, and they started using Anorexia and Bulimia Anonymous, and so they started using the same language. And I was a young therapist at the time, and I had clients coming into my office and saying, oh, I went to this OA meeting, and I asked them about what it was, because I'd never been to a 12-step meeting. And, oh, well, we go around a circle, and I admit that I'm powerless over food. And I was really taken aback, you know. Like, my whole work with people was, oh, no, you're way more powerful than food, you know. And I didn't really, so I learned about it as the clients were telling me. I realized when I was treating these clients who were trying to do it from a 12-step perspective, their whole idea was they were going to have this for the rest of their life.
Right.
And I found that incompatible with my own experience and incompatible with what I think about the human being and their resources to be able to get past something like this, particularly since it's something you need to do. You can get alcohol out of your life, of course. You can
sure.
not have to take drugs, but you have to eat. So having that same relationship or philosophy about food didn't make any sense to me.
Sure.
But I think it stuck in a way. I think it stuck. And it's been revived with a new emphasis now that researchers place on the genetics about, you know, people with eating disorders have a genetic predisposition. So now it's sort of revived mm-hmm. in the 90s, really, with this idea that, oh, it's genetics, so of course you always have it. But if you really look behind the genetics, at least as far as we know right now, it's just a vulnerability. Mm-hmm. It's a predisposition, and it's something that like I admit, and I don't know the two of you well enough to know how you would relate to this, but I admit that I have those genetic traits, like being perfectionistic or anxious, you know, and
yes,
those kind of traits. Yeah, I was born with those traits, and but I don't think that means that you have to have the eating disorder for the rest of your life. You may have to deal with those traits in a new way,
mm-hmm, sure,
but I certainly think you can be recovered from the eating disorder. And I have some things to say about those traits, but I'll stop and take a breath. See.
Well, I think it's also very important for our listeners to understand that both Kelly and I have talked about eating disorders before on the show, because we both have a background in also treating them. But from your expertise, could you please tell our listeners the differences between bulimia, anorexia, what the current diagnoses are,
binge eating,
obesity, et cetera? Because I know there's a lot of confusion still about those distinctions.
Well, anorexia nervosa really is the trump card in terms of the, you know, the diagnostic criteria in terms of being one of the strongest in terms of the effects of the eating disorder. Anorexia nervosa, I say trump card, because more people die of anorexia than any other mental illness. And anorexia is easily identifiable in the sense of you can see it on a person. It is sort of commiserate with extreme weight loss. And I'll get back to that in a minute, because the definition has changed a little. But it really means when a person has sort of an undue influence of weight and shape, take an undue influence on their self-esteem. So they become almost phobic about being fat, gaining weight, and these are people who are very restrictive in what they eat. However, there's a subcategory, and this is where people get confused. There's a subcategory of people with anorexia who also purge, or sometimes binge and purge, but for the most part, they're restricting their calories enough that they become fairly emaciated.
Mm-hmm.
The criteria in terms of weight was taken out of the DSM-5 because you can have somebody that's well on their way to anorexia, and let's say it was supposed to be, I think, below an 18.5 BMI, but you would have someone coming for treatment who, let's say, they already lost 50 pounds, who were quite ill, quite weak, very restricted, obsessive about not, mm-hmm, and paranoid about not getting fat, but they hadn't gone below that 18.5 threshold, and they weren't meeting the insurance requirements to get in.
Right.
So there's a big fight about taking out the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, anorexia is just seen as a sort of a morbid fear of weight gain and eating food that's going to cause weight gain and being fat. Bulimia gets often confused with purging, and basically, to be diagnosed with bulimia, you have to binge. Bulimia involves someone who binges and then compensates for those binges by some form of purging, whether it is vomiting to lose the weight or some kind of other
laxatives
or
excessive,
something like that, mm-hmm, or some compensatory behavior like compulsively exercising,
sure,
to burn the calories.
Uh-huh.
And then binge eating disorder is a newly added, even though it's probably the one that's been recognized the most, going all the way back to what I was saying about Overeaters Anonymous.
Yeah.
Binge eating disorder, the person does not have the compensatory behaviors. So people who have binge eating disorder, and binging is seen as someone who eats a huge amount of food in a short period of time,
mm-hmm,
and they feel unable to control it or to stop doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people confuse, you mentioned obesity, binge eating disorder with obesity. Not everybody who is obese,
mm-hmm,
has binge eating disorder, but often we look at people who are, quote, you know, overweight, and assume that they have binge eating disorder, but it's not really true. Obesity in and of itself is a physical condition. It's not a mental illness, not a mental DSM diagnosis, you know?
Yes. That was a beautiful,
beautiful explanation. Yeah. Yes.
And then the
other thing
I wanted to add, so my background is I was anorexic and then I was also orthorexic. And I wanted to hear what your thoughts about that. And that is when you have this obsessive, basically obsessive control about having only healthy food. It has to be perfect. It has to be healthy.
You know, interestingly enough, I don't know how sick you got, but but really some of the sickest patients I have ever seen started out with orthorexia. And I think partly that might be because it's so... condoned. What do I want to say? It's so held up in certain circles as being, wow, you're so healthy, you're so great, you don't need any fat, you know, you have such a healthy, good, you know, diet, and they'll go into yoga communities or certain communities that reinforce it, and they get highly reinforced for this. And I think if you already have this propensity that I talked about earlier, you tend to be that kind of personality type, then you'll take things to the extreme. You have the ability to take things to the extreme. And what happens over time when you're restricting is that your brain gets sort of hijacked, and at some point you don't see yourself anymore. You're unable to break out of this. It's almost like you've now created these neural pathways in your brain that you have to eat like this, and that anything else is bad, or you're undisciplined, or even worse than that, you're going to fall apart, you're going to be unworthy, it's like sinning, you know? And so what happens is it starts out as healthy food, and then it becomes raw food. And then I just had a client who... she only ate food that, as she put it, wanted to be eaten. So I asked her, what does that mean? Well, only food that, you know, falls from a tree or from a bush or something like that. It has to be food that is, you know, nature's way of saying you want to be eaten. And she just went into the hospital a couple of weeks ago with, you know, organ failure, and her whole body shutting down. And this is after years, but me and other people trying to tell her what you're doing in the guise of health, can't you see, you know, it's not making you healthy.
I'm so glad that you're bringing this up, because I think it's more prevalent than people think. And I think that you described me perfectly. I mean, I will tell a story because I think it'll be probably relatable to people. It was probably about 10 years ago. And I was in this orthorexic phase, and I went to a restaurant, you guys are going to die, and I brought my own organic eggs in and said, could you cook an omelet with these eggs? Because they're the highest quality. The waiter looked at me like I had three heads. And at that time, I'm like, what's the problem? Like,
this was only 10 years ago.
This was like probably 10 years ago. Yeah, it was probably maybe 11 or 12.
Everything, you know, what happens is you lose your freedom. I think it's okay to want to eat organic foods. Mm-hmm. I understand that in this culture and all we're learning about what's happening with foods and all that. And I think it's okay to even people who want a vegetarian or even a vegan diet, although the stricter you get vegan, orthorexic, and you combine that with a personality of someone who has an eating disorder or has a propensity to have an eating disorder, there's where you get into problems. But it has to be preference, you know?
Right.
It needs to be that you have this preference to eat like that, but you realize that you can eat something else rather than starve yourself.
Exactly.
Well, I can assure you, Carolyn, that sure as shit, Kelly has conquered that one, because give her dark chocolate anywhere, anytime, any place,
exactly,
and she will devour it. She will hide in the closets to make sure that her
kids
don't bother her while she's indulging and enjoying her chocolate.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, and that's why I love at the beginning when you talk about how people can be fully recovered, because I think that gives so much hope. Like, I think that when, you know, it's very daunting when you hear, like, oh, you're going to have to deal with this for the rest of your life. I mean, you feel like you're in a prison sentence. And I love the idea that, no, you can get over this. You know, it's possible.
So what was
your... I think it's been a self-fulfilling prophecy. How many people were saying, you have to deal with this for your life and you'll always be recovered and you have to manage your illness. Yeah. I think it's really hurt the field for a number of years. And Deborah knows, I have been forever standing up and saying you can be recovered, and I'm astonished that I still have to fight this fight.
Right. So give us some, you know, an outline of how that happened for you. How did you, what motivated you? Because a lot of anorexics, they don't think they have a problem. It's the rest of the world that's worried about them, but they're fine in their mind until they get super sick. So had you gotten super sick yourself and that forced you into some sort of therapy, or what was your path?
No, but I mean, yes, I got super sick and lost a ton of weight, probably 40 pounds before I had any kind of aha moment. But back then, there wasn't anyone for me to see. I mean, I tried to go to the school counselor at the college where I was going to school, and, you know, she just didn't know what to do with me. And then I tried this other doctor in Beverly Hills. You know, I was here living in California, and and he thought I was so interesting. He wanted to see what I would do if he gave me a Coke to drink. You know, so I never went back to see him.
Sadistic.
I think that a big part of it, in a way, was me having this realization that I had these two selves, and this is the major form of my treatment protocol, is that I realized that I had a healthy core self inside, and that what I would recommend other people do was completely different than what I was allowing myself to do. And somehow, I don't know, maybe it was the gift that I was supposed to get to use this later to help people, but I realized that I had these two voices almost, you know, in my head. And when you talk to people with eating disorders, even those with anorexia, although it's harder to get them going with it, I'll say more about that in a minute, but I realized that there was a part of me that was... very, like, on the way, I remember this experience on the way to a Christmas party where I was in the car and I was telling myself, okay, when you get into that party, you're not going to have anything, not one bite, not a cookie, not a piece of candy, nothing. Another part of me said, oh, you know, that's easy for you to do. If you really want to show you have willpower, you would eat one or two and just be okay with that. My other voice immediately said back, oh, you're just trying to let her off the hook and let her eat. And here I was in this dialogue with myself. And my philosophy of treating people with eating disorders is I don't try to take it away from them. I don't tell them, you know, I don't challenge and go after the eating disorder. I always tell them the battle is not between me and you or your parents and you or the treatment team and you. It's between you and you, you and you. And getting their healthy self inside there, and they all have one. Everyone with an eating disorder who comes to see you, I mean, who, even if they're very whacked out with all these weird thoughts and ideas, deep down they have a healthy core self that they were born with. And it's finding that part of them and strengthening that part of them, building it back up, and then it takes care of the eating disorder part.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. I love that.
So, okay. I mean, it's so interesting because I loved when you talked about the neural pathways almost being, you know, hijacked and damaged. And
yes, and they are.
Yeah. And so how do you feel like people sort of come back from that? I mean, is it this self-talk of kind of getting that healthy persona to kind of be up front, or?
Well, first it's perhaps getting the person to see that they have, well, let me say this, in the book there's a whole thing about the stages of integrating these two selves, because ultimately I see it as I'm not getting rid of your eating disorder self, I'm going to help you integrate back into one whole person because you're a split personality now. Yeah. And I can prove that to them very easily by doing something like this. Let's say you have bulimia. I'm working with a client with bulimia, mm-hmm. and she says, oh, my God, I ate all this ice cream last night, and I just knew I had to purge because, you know, I'm so worried about gaining weight. And I say, okay, you know, that seven-year-old that you babysit on the weekends, what if she ate two bowls of ice cream and came to you and said, I have to purge. I have to get rid of this because I'm going to get fat. What would you tell her?
Mm-hmm.
I never have the client say, oh, yeah, I tell you, better throw that up, honey. You're going to gain weight. Never.
Right.
They always have a healthy self in there for mm-hmm. others.
Uh-huh. Right.
Right.
They don't use it for themselves. So first I get them to identify these eating disorder thoughts they have, writing them down, and then I hand it back to them and say, okay, what do you say back to her?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you have to say, pretend like it's somebody else, because when they think of it as themselves, they get stuck.
Right. We can do it.
So it's having them practice. I think what we often do with people is we become their healthy voice.
Yes.
We sit in a room with a client, and the client says all these negative things, and then we say all the positive things back, reminding them, and then they say mm-hmm. the negative things. And what we have to do is stop and flip it and say, no, you talk back to yourself.
Yeah.
That's the only way to get that healthy self in there practicing, mm-hmm. beginning to speak up for itself. And over time, it's still hard. I'm this conversation can make it sound easy. It's still really hard for them to do, and they get stuck, and sometimes they get in these dialogues, and the eating disorder self wins. So I'll do role plays in my office. I have them even switch the chair, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other really, really important thing is to have them reach out for somebody. So I'm the type of therapist that my clients can text me. So for example, I will say to someone, okay, this is going to be a really hard week. We've been doing a lot of work. So if you're doing this dialogue and you feel like the eating disorder self is winning and you're going to go purge or binge,
mm-hmm.
call me, text me.
Yeah.
Because when they do that, getting them to do that is hard. It's not like people think, like, oh, you're going to have all these clients calling you all week. It's not like that because, you know, if you want to do a behavior like that, you don't want to call your therapist and admit it.
Right, of course.
So basically,
yeah.
What you do is you get the person to reach out to you, because who's going to do the reaching out? Their healthy self.
Yep.
It's the healthy self who's going to make that text or make that call. And I can generally often respond with a simple text. Sometimes I'll call. It's a short conversation. It's not so much my response. The healing part is that they've brought their healthy self forward and reached out to a person rather than the behavior to get their needs met at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, I'm glad that you're speaking about this, because I kind of do that a lot with my clients too, getting them to dialogue mm-hmm. with themselves. It is really important because it does empower them and help them recognize their agenda with themselves.
Right.
I also wanted to share a little bit personally, too. You were talking about your orthorexia. I had in my anorexic state years ago, most of my friends, we would ditch school and we would go to this little coffee shop
mm-hmm.
and everybody would order breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And I would order a side of one pancake. And they would always say, well, why aren't you just eating everything? I said, no, that was my deal with myself. I would have one pancake
mm-hmm.
at breakfast, and then I would have nothing all day, and then I'd eat iceberg lettuce at night. And I dropped from, you know, a healthy, normal weight to 89 pounds, and I'm 5'7.5". And my parents didn't even notice. They said, you look great. I was emaciated. It was astonishing.
And then that
turned into progressed to bulimia and all that kind of stuff. And, I'm with you there, Carolyn. When I went to therapy, I couldn't find a therapist who knew anything about eating disorders. It was it was tragic. So I literally kind of healed that myself and then got into the whole trying to help other people with that as well. So it is a challenge. Now, for me, it took probably, I'm going to say, 5 to 7 years to develop a healthy relationship
mm-hmm.
to food
yep.
ongoingly. What would you say is like the average when you tell somebody, okay, we're going to do this work together, but you got to commit to what?
Well, it's interesting that you say the 5 to 7 years, because actually that's a number that's touted a lot, and I used to say to people, you know, the research shows this, but the reality is it's all over the place, so I don't say that anymore, because then I feel like in with some people, it almost gives them the idea that, this is going to be so long and dragged out,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, but I think it's, I mean, it makes sense because there, and I don't know, this is very old research, so I haven't even seen any new research about how long it takes, but we're also different. I mean, I had a 50-year-old woman who had anorexia who basically, since she was about 10, mm-hmm. who really in about 6 months was recovered and has not, and is still,
wow,
2 years later.
That's
so
amazing.
It's so interesting to me. You know, I just tell people, this, it's a process.
Sure.
Yes.
This is not going to flip around. It's,
yeah,
not, it's not going to turn on a dime. It's a process. And especially since you're strengthening this part of yourself and you are creating new neural pathways.
Yes.
Because if you for a very long time, it's like riding a bike or anything, if you purge every time you eat something, quote, fattening, you have now created this pathway in your brain. You eat that pizza, you immediately, not only do you think about purging, your body gets ready for it.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Yes,
You're primed for it. And you almost feel weird. You do feel weird if you don't do it. So creating new neural pathways is having somebody, you know, texting somebody or having somebody there with you, taking a few bites of pizza first, then having a whole piece and keeping it. You have to create new neural pathways.
Mm-hmm. What constitutes recovered? In other words, does that mean that somebody who was, you know, so obsessed with food and not eating it or eating it or purging never has that experience again? Or because I would say that there's still occasionally where I look at myself and go, oh God, I look fat, or it's not very often and I don't give it any power.
Oh, I'm glad you asked that, because think about it. If that were an eating disorder, then 90%
yeah, exactly.
of females on
We're
the planet,
fucked.
If not more, would be currently diagnosable.
Yes, yes.
And I think what started to happen is people started to expect more of recovered patients than of normal people, which is not fair.
Right. Good
point. I think that you can be recovered from an eating disorder. I mean, you look at the diagnostic criteria and you go, well, they don't meet that. But
right.
But I have higher standards than that, because the diagnostic criteria, you know, the binging criteria, if I'm treating someone, for example, with bulimia or binge eating disorder, I mean, to me, well, let's put binge eating disorder aside for a minute. With bulimia, I want zero incidences of binging and purging, if I'm going to count that as being recovered, you know, zero incidences. Do I care about if you have bad body image days? No. I mean, I care, but not in terms of whether you call yourself recovered or not. Because in this culture, I think it's really difficult not to have issues with your body and how you look.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that got all mixed up with defining whether a person was recovered or not. You see what I mean?
Yes.
It just doesn't seem fair.
Yeah.
But I do think that, you know, with anorexia, for example, you have to be weight restored, and certainly one of the markers we use for that is not necessarily a number on the scale, but, you know, are you menstruating again?
Yes.
You know,
right.
Yes.
That's a really good sign.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And things like that, and I like to look for things like that, body temperature. Have you lost the hair that's on your,
mm-hmm.
you know, the lanugo hair that they grow to keep themselves warm? I like to look at those things rather than what I think treatment programs make a huge mistake of doing is, oh, you weigh this, you are this height, you have to weigh this.
Yes.
And I think it freaks them out, and I think that it's really difficult for any of us to look at any other one of us and say, you should weigh X.
Yes.
That's also something that is, I think we rely on it too much, when really we have to say, are you able to eat foods that nourish your body? You know, are you able to sustain your life force and, mm-hmm. you know, your pulse and your temperature and your
right.
bone density and your menstruation and those kind of things, you know? But I have a definition for recovered that I came up with, because people ask me all the time this question, well, what do you call recovered? What do you call it if you say we can be it? You want me to, I have part of it here.
Yes, please.
Yes, please.
It's in the book, and this is a, not the full version, but it's close. And it's basically when the person can accept his or her natural body size and shape and no longer has a self-destructive or unnatural relationship with food or exercise. When food and weight take their proper perspective, when you are recovered, you do not use eating disorder behaviors to deal with, distract from, or cope with other problems. And when you are recovered, this is my favorite part, you will not compromise your health or betray your soul to look a certain way, wear a certain size, or reach a certain number on the scale.
Oh, I love that.
And to me, that's it. And I put that up in my office, and I tell people, this is where we're going.
Yeah.
You know, so they know, so they have an idea. This is where we're going. It's a journey, but it's where we're headed.
I love
that. Love that.
And
perfect.
I wanted to add, too, so do you recommend that patients also see a nutritionist?
Oh my God, I was just wrote that question down that I wanted to ask.
Well, I was going to say, because for me that was instrumental, and I saw an intuitive eating nutritionist that I think is just amazing, because I love that philosophy where I sort of had to relearn all of these, you know, behaviors. I mean, I kind of had all these rigid rules, and suddenly it was like, well, no, you know, what do you feel like eating? And I'm like, what? What does that even mean? You know, I had so disconnected from that. But yeah, I would love your thoughts around
maybe
that.
Maybe we could break that into two components, Carol.
Go ahead, Deborah.
Yeah, I just think if we could put that in two components, because I think they're both essential. One is, what does the role of a nutritionist play? But also, I hear a lot, and also like the intuitive eating model, but many people have said, and I think there's some element of truth to this, I want your opinion, that an anorexic in the early stages of being recovered can't do intuitive eating because they've lost their sensations.
That's what I would say.
Okay,
so I'll address both of those.
Perfect.
I already forgot the first one. I was going to go on to intuitive
eating.
The role of
a nutritionist, but go with either one.
The nutritionist is, again, it depends. And I say that because for the first probably 10 years of my private practice, and remember, I became a therapist in 1979. Okay. The nutritionist, are you kidding? I mean, they were the people that were in the elementary school lunch line, you know, with the hairnet serving us, you know, our food. You know what I mean? I mean, there was no possible way that there was a dietitian or nutritionist that was anywhere near I could find who knew anything about eating disorders. So for years, I had a private practice, very successful, with all kinds of eating disorders, without one. So now, having said that, once nutritionists came on the scene and once I had them, they're a great addition because you have a lot of work with someone with an eating disorder. And so if someone else can be doing that other piece and working it out, but if you do, you have to be together as a team. That's the thing where I see it go bad, is where the nutritionist is saying one thing and the therapist is saying another. Or where the let's say the client wants to talk to the therapist about her weight or about something about food, and the therapist says, no, talk to your nutritionist. And I think that encourages a split between the client. I can only talk about my feelings here and my food over there. And so I think you just have to be coordinated in the care. And then I love nutritionists. I mean, dietitians at Montanito, you know, it was just so great to be able to have people having their roles, and then we all would meet together and make sure we were on the same page and all that. I think it's, and sometimes I think it's pretty imperative, but I don't think it's always necessary. There are sometimes when some adolescents I see can get into real trouble when they feel like, okay, I have to go to family therapy, and I go to my psychiatrist, and I go to my therapist, and I go to my nutritionist, and it becomes kind of a blur, you know? And so if the doctor and the therapist can do enough with this particular client about making sure that they're on a meal plan or eating enough, and especially getting the parents involved in it and all that, then sometimes, you know, you don't need one. And I hope people out there don't think I'm saying, you know, it's completely unnecessary. I just think each case is a little bit different, what people need. And I think you have to look at each case like that and consider all the possible options you have and use them when they're right.
Sure.
Absolutely.
And about intuitive eating, I really love and appreciate the whole intuitive eating thing, I want to call it, I don't know, approach or thing that sort of swept the country and into treatment centers, you know, and I know Elise, you know, and I know the people who wrote the book, mm-hmm. But I have had some challenges with it, and since what Deborah was talking about, when you have anorexia nervosa, you can't intuitively eat because your intuition is all off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's just been so disrupted, and so I use this term conscious eating, and intuitive eating is a piece of conscious eating. And the only reason I use conscious eating, and that's also described in the 8 Keys book and workbook, is that there's a way that you can learn how to eat consciously. It's not always intuitive. You can eat consciously when you're on your meal plan in the beginning, you know?
Right.
And some people have to be on a meal plan in the beginning, because if you tell them, eat according to what you want or your intuition, it's just so fouled up they can't do it.
They just can't do it. Because they get
sense.
Confused.
But
I
it's funny, because Elise told me that they almost called their first book Conscious Eating.
That's so funny.
So she and I have had big laughs over this, you know, and they would agree. They will say it's not useful for anorexia nervosa in the initial stages.
Yeah. That's fascinating. Wow. Gosh. Well, we're almost out of time. We've been talking with Carolyn Costin. She is the author of 8 Keys to Recovery from an Eating Disorder. You are so knowledgeable, so insightful.
God.
This has been amazing and super fascinating.
So engaging.
Wow. Thank you.
But we have a few more minutes, and we'd like to give you the floor of, one, are there some things that we didn't cover today that you would really like to highlight and leave for our listeners? And then also, we want to promote the crap out of you because you're amazing.
Okay. Well, I guess what I would say is the field of eating disorders is looking at now, you know, there's a lot of things coming up about neuroscience and how that relates. What I'm excited about is how the neuroscience relates to and sort of backs up things that certainly I have used for a long time in terms of mindfulness, teaching people mindfulness practices, breathing, yoga, those kinds of things, and how they help people with eating disorders. And now we know it's not just because it's some woo-woo thing, you know.
Right.
When I opened Montanito and taught meditation and yoga there, you know, I was the woo-woo California therapist. But now there's a lot of, we know now that these practices help change the brain.
Sure.
And changing the brain in terms of, like, people with anorexia nervosa being highly anxious, and it looks like they are very similar to people with other anxiety disorders in that they have a hyperamygdala response, you know, mm-hmm. that part of the brain that controls the emotions. And things like mindfulness and meditation actually help that, actually
yes.
help the brain with that. And I won't go into all the details, but I think it's exciting to look where things are going in that way, in terms of the future of things to do for the field, you know. And I already said the thing about coaching.
And you
so, and I'm talking a little bit about that. At the end of this month, Friday, April 26th, at the CAMPT conference in Orange County, I'm doing this talk, which I can't even believe, called Quantum Physics, Eating Disorders, Quantum Physics, Neuroscience, Spirituality, and Eating Disorders.
That's amazing.
That's fantastic. Wow.
I don't, what possessed me, I don't know. But I'm linking all these things together and how helping people see the power of their mind, really, and who they are as deeper, you know,
mm-hmm.
More powerful spiritual beings, and not just caught up in the ego mind and all that, and relating that to eating disorders. So wish me luck on that one.
Yes, you're going to do wonderful.
And then is there another book that you want to share with our listeners? Because I know you said you have 6 books published.
Yes, and a new one coming out, yes? Or
No. I don't have a new one coming out. Bite your tongue, because I said after the last one, no more. But I think there is another one in me. It's probably going to be about this topic that I'm talking about.
Oh, that's great.
Love it.
At CAMPT. But I would say probably the one that I think is, besides the Eight Keys book, the one, it depends. If people are listening and they really want to know more about guidelines and stuff for treatment and how to treat, probably the Eating Disorder Source Book.
Okay.
But if people are more into this other, what's happening, the new stuff emerging, the mindfulness and yoga and things like that, I actually edited a book with several authors, either yoga practitioners or people who have healed with yoga as a part of their treatment, called such an easy title, a creative title, Yoga and Eating Disorders.
But
the subtitle is interesting, ancient healing for a modern illness, and that's probably a book that people wouldn't normally think about maybe. And there's some really great stuff in there. Particularly, there's a great chapter by a guy who wrote a book recently you probably heard of about yoga and healing trauma and PTSD.
Awesome.
And he has a chapter in there on yoga and eating disorder.
Great. Carolyn, you have been fantastic.
So great.
We had the pleasure of speaking with Carolyn Costin. That's Costin. And you can find her at carolyncostin.com. And Kelly, next week we have Catherine Woodard Thomas, conscious uncoupling.
Okay. I can't wait. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks.
It's been my pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
We'll see you guys next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.